It sounds like the stuff of science fiction. There's no doubt about it. Taking human genes and putting them into animal eggs. This is not the first time someone's been trying to do this. And if you've been looking at the news, perhaps you saw the Associated Press story, cloning idea revisited. British scientists are inserting human genes into animal eggs. We'll find out what kind of brave new world we are entering or have already entered with Barbara Quigley here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. We'll spend about 20 minutes with Barbara, then Suzanne Venker will join us to talk about a new study on the impact of daycare on children. Suzanne is author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Doug LeBlanc will be our guest at about 3:45, thereabouts, to round off the first hour of the program. I don't know if you've heard about these, Jubus. They're not candy. They're not the latest. It's not the latest dance craze. It is a Jew who practices Buddhism. And they're more common, especially here in America, than you might believe. We'll talk with Doug LeBlanc of the Christian Research Journal about Jubus there in the latter part of this first hour. The second hour of the program, we'll discuss Christian teaching. Pastor Ronnie Koch of Good News Magazine will be our guest. And then in the third hour of the program, audio open lines. There's an NBC Today Show interview with the author of a new book. I can't even call this a book. He says it's actually a gospel. It's a gospel that he has written. It's a cooperative effort between a best-selling author and a leading Roman Catholic New Testament scholar. And it's the gospel according to Judas. Now, it's not the Judas gospel that we talk about. It's an entirely new gospel written by this author from the perspective of Judas. And we'll hear a little bit from the Today Show on that. Also in audio open lines, a Today Show debate on the Jesus Tomb documentary. They're still arguing about it. And, of course, an update on Warren Jeffs, who has an entire compound, or had an entire compound, of polygamist Mormons, and he's in legal trouble. That will, well, we'll do as much as we can there in the third hour of Issues Etc. during audio open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us as we come to you live this Tuesday, the 27th of March. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Barbara Quigley is Executive Director of the St. Louis Center for Bioethics and Culture. She joins us to talk about splicing genes, putting human genes into animal eggs. It sounds like science fiction. Barbara, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
What exactly are they retrying here in Great Britain, the scientists?
Well, what this is actually is cloning human embryos, but instead of using eggs from women, they want to use eggs from animals because procuring enough eggs from women to do this kind of research has been difficult.
Okay, so another form of cloning human embryos. Before we get to the egg issue, are there concerns that people should have when an animal egg is used with human genes?
Oh, certainly. We're creating a chimera, a combination of human being and animal. Even though it would be 99% human, there is some genetic material from the animal. We don't know what the impact of placing a human genes in an animal egg would be in terms of development. But this is just another way of creating a human, at least theoretically, creating a human embryo for use in research.
Now, the greater concern is the ethical one.
Right.
And that is, if this is just another form of human cloning for the purpose of destroying that human embryo through destructive biomedical research, this is really no different than what we're talking about here in the States with embryonic stem cell research, is it?
Well, it's different only in the fact that now we're also combining human genetic material with an animal. So we've got the added ethical issue of creating a human-animal combination in order to extract stem cells for research. So that just adds one more level of ethical complexity to the discussion, I think.
So is it the stated purpose of these British researchers to create, by whatever means they need to, human embryos for the harvesting of human stem cells?
Right. That's correct. What they want to do this in order to study embryonic development and to use in studying different disease processes, how they develop. They can be used for testing pharmaceuticals also.
Let's talk about the so-called bottleneck to cloning.
Right.
As it appears in the Associated Press story, the researchers say, look, we need human eggs. If we can't get them, we'll use animal eggs. Does that summarize it pretty well?
Yes.
Why can't they get the human eggs?
Well, there is a risk to women in donating the eggs. Women usually are paid for their eggs, even though it's called donation. In order to get enough eggs, even for use in infertility clinics for couples who are trying to create children through in vitro fertilization, these clinics advertise for young women to be donors of eggs, and donors are in short supply. In Great Britain, they go overseas just to recruit. In Eastern Europe, there have been some infertility clinics who have recruited young women there because it's less expensive and because they don't have enough donors in their own country. So we don't even have enough donors to do a lot of the IVF procedures that people want. We're certainly not going to be able to produce enough eggs in the thousands and thousands that they're going to want to use for research.
We have been told, especially here in Missouri last year, with the big push for Amendment 2 that would have made legal in Missouri anything legal at the federal level regarding human cloning, even though it passed itself off as a ban on human cloning. We were never told that there would be a bottleneck of human eggs. It made it sound like there was plenty to go around, and this kind of research was simply waiting for the permission of the Missouri voters.
Right. Well, I think there are a lot of things we didn't hear about last year that would have made the decision a little bit more easy for us. But that is a fact. I mean, scientists who are conducting embryonic stem cell research are the first ones to say that this is the real issue. The real difficulty in proceeding is the lack of sufficient numbers of eggs from young women. So this is an alternative proposal that will allow them to go forward with an unlimited supply of eggs because you can, you know, animals, they can procure those easily without the ethical issues and the moral constraints that would be applied to human egg donation.
Could this happen in the U.S.? Would a researcher trying this in the U.S. be running afoul of any laws?
There is no regulation in the United States. There's nothing to prohibit anyone in the United States from doing this research. So, no. There are some countries. Canada has prohibited it. Other countries, my understanding is that countries who have a ban on human cloning have also included the creation of chimeras. But in the United States, we have no ban on this procedure.
Many people are under the impression that there is some kind of a ban given President George W. Bush's August 2001 directive regarding federal funding for sources of embryonic stem cells. Can you clear this up for us?
The only ban is the use of federal funds for human cloning research, so that if a researcher is able to find money from private sources, there is no prohibition against human cloning or embryonic stem cell research. It is simply unlawful to use federal funding for this kind of research.
It's ironic that the British researchers here, who are causing such a stir, actually have to get governmental permission to do this stuff.
Yes, but it seems to be forthcoming. So I would like to see a ban on using eggs for research, donation of eggs for research, as well as a ban, obviously, on human cloning and chimeras. But I think we're seeing right now in the Senate, actually, a bill that being put forward by Senators Feinstein and Hatch that is very much reminds me of what we saw in Missouri last year, a ban on human cloning that really isn't a ban, and you know, we'll see how easily that may proceed. I'm sure Bush would veto it, but I think it would be difficult at the federal level right now to get a ban on human cloning or the production of chimeras.
Okay, I'm curious about that because with all the stir here in Missouri over Amendment 2, it sounds as though if such a federal bill were to somehow make it past the president's desk, it would render all of these things moot. We would have finally some federal legislation on human cloning.
Right, that's right. I'm not a legal scholar either, but it seems to me that that would be the case, yes. So it is of concern to me that what happened to us here in Missouri is trying to be pushed on the rest of the United States at the federal level.
Before we let you go, lay it out for us in the simplest terms possible. What are your concerns, your complex of concerns, about what happened in Great Britain, injecting human genes into animal eggs for the purpose of creating a human embryo and harvesting the stem cells?
Well, it's the same concerns we had with creating cloned human embryos using women's eggs, that we are cloning human beings, but now we're actually cloning human beings that are combined with animal genetic material. So we're creating a new sort of kind of human being that's going to be used as a research subject and destroyed within 2 weeks of its creation. It paves the way for additional cloning of human embryos in using human eggs. I think it's one way of scientists being able to perfect the ability to clone and then easily transfer that to the cloning of human embryos with human eggs and using human beings as research subjects. But now we have human beings that are mostly human but part animal too.
And what concerns me there is that it would seem to add a little fuel to the fire and the argument that someone says, look, what's really important here is that none of these human clones ever make it to term, and all the more reason to use them for the quote-unquote beneficial stem cells we can get from them. After all, they're not even fully human.
Yeah. Well, that depends. I suppose you could use that argument, but why should we be creating a human, sort of hybrid human being in the first place? And we're going into uncharted territory that I think is dangerous. The combination of various species, I think, is very problematic. We don't know what we're going to get at the other end of this. There are lots of scenarios that could include the transmission of animal diseases to human beings through therapies created in this way, the creation of animals and or humans with characteristics of other species in ways we don't know, what their experience of life is, creating organisms we don't know how to name or how to treat. I just think that this is a road down which we should not be traveling, but I think also it's the issue of cloning human embryos for research purposes is the bottom line. There are other avenues to create stem cell treatments that are more effective, that don't have the ethical problems of embryonic stem cell research and cloning, that are rendering more effective treatments that are more easily obtainable, and there's no need for us to go in this way. I believe scientists are really more interested in discovering how the body works, how embryos develop, disease processes, and that sort of thing. But we can do that in animal models. We don't need to be cloning human embryos. And perhaps there are some things we will never know if we can't use human beings as research subjects, but I think then that's the way it needs to be.
STLCBC.com is the website address for St. Louis Center for Bioethics and Culture, STLCBC.com. Barbara Quigley is Executive Director of the St. Louis Center for Bioethics and Culture. Barbara, thank you again for being our guest.
You're welcome.
We're going to be talking here for the remainder of this segment with Suzanne Venker and a little bit beyond. Suzanne is a former middle school English teacher and married mother of two here in St. Louis. There's a new study on the impact of daycare on children. Before we welcome Suzanne to the microphone, let's hear this from ABC News.
Parents often worry that daycare centers may leave their child at a disadvantage compared to kids who have a stay-at-home mother during their early years. But results from a long-term study of over 1,300 kids finds that daycare centers may actually provide some benefits. Researchers track the children from birth, checking periodically to see what kind of child care they received when they were young. Now, in sixth grade, the kids who had high-quality daycare had larger vocabularies. Researchers say that increased time with attentive adults probably gives these children a boost in verbal ability. However, the news wasn't all positive. Kids who spent more time in daycare centers were also more likely to act out in school as they got older. But the study has also revealed that the effects of daycare are minuscule compared to the impact parents have. Scientists have followed the kids for more than a decade now, and they have found each year that parents have the most influence on a child's academic and social behavior. With this Medical Minute, I'm Dr. Timothy Johnson.
Suzanne Venker joins us. She's a former middle school English teacher, married mother of two here in St. Louis, and author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers to React to this new study on the impact of daycare. Suzanne, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Heck, if you could have a kid who's more verbal, but maybe acting out a little bit more, and the researchers will assure you that you still have the lion's share of the influence on your child, why worry about daycare?
Yeah, that little segment you played was what they call spin. They took the facts of the study and just spun it to the way they wanted it to sound, which was that listening to what you just played, the focus was on, wow, daycare can actually have some benefit to children via their vocabulary. Oh yeah, and by the way, there is a small problem that might occur as well, but that's not so much of a concern, meaning that they might act out and be a little more aggressive and be major discipline problems later in life, which actually was the focus of the study. It was on the discipline part and the behavioral aspects of this, and then the vocabulary thing is, you would think, far less significant because of the reason you just pointed out. If I had to choose between a five-year-old with a great vocabulary and completely out-of-control behavior and the reverse, I think I'll take the reverse.
So what did this study really have to say, if it's read objectively, about the impact of daycare on kids?
Okay. The study has been ongoing for many years, and it's the most comprehensive daycare study we have to date from the National Institute of Child and Health Development. They've tracked 1,364 children, the same children, over a period of time. And they have controlled for things like race, income, education of mother, and what they're trying to focus on specifically is how harmful is daycare. That's it, bottom line. And what they concluded, not just today, this didn't just come out, the news that they came out with yesterday was in many ways more of a reiteration of what they concluded in April of 2001, which was that unequivocally, no matter what other issues you look at or how you want to quantify it in other ways, there is an undeniable connection between time in care and aggressive or bad behavior, if you will, of children. Now, that means that does not mean that any child who is exposed to any type of daycare or any amount of daycare automatically becomes a nightmare to deal with later. It simply means that what we know for sure is that the more time they're in there and the more time they're away from mom, the more influences, of course, actually they don't even get into influences, I'll add that as a caveat in a minute, that the more likely they are to be aggressive in a bad way. And I say in a bad way because you'll get the media once again to spin aggressive and say, well, isn't it good for kids to be assertive? Which, of course, being assertive is not the same as being aggressive. You might want your child to learn how to be assertive and state his or her wants, but you don't want them to go about it in an aggressive manner and knocking people down in order to get there. So these are all the ways in which the media spin the issue of daycare because, of course, they don't want ever to say anything negative about it.
So what's your caveat on influences?
My caveat on influences was that they won't say, and the study doesn't say, the people who research this won't come out and say point blank that the reason for this is because of this. And they hesitate to do that because it is very difficult to point it out, but they do allude to it. I take it a step further and say it's obvious that the influences that children are having at such a young age as compared with the ones who are at home and are having the primary influence of the one constant in his or her life, i.e. mom, obviously you're not going to come out the same way. It's just not possible. You're being raised basically in an institution-like environment with all these other children from 6 weeks on up.
you know, some 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, you're not going to churn out the same kind of kid as the one who's at home with mom. That's just common sense, and people know that instinctively, which is why they always kind of say under their breath, you know, how much daycare they're using, because they don't want it to seem like they think it's okay to be in there for long periods of time. But the purpose of this study that that we're talking about is that it keeps coming up with the same connection, and that's really all we need to hear, and that's what the ABC News should have stated, when they, of course, they never will, which is not what they did say, what you aired, but that they should say that there is an absolute connection between the amount of time children spend in daycare and their poor behavior, aggressive behavior, or to be more specifically, I have the actual study in my hand from the NICHD. They say, they use the terms, or the phrases rather, hold on here, gets in many fights, disobedient at school, and argues a lot. And then they just came up with the term aggressive to kind of encompass all those phrases.
Did the study distinguish daycare from daycare? Institutional
right.
daycare, long-term kind of day-in, day-out daycare from what some people might classify as daycare,
right.
blurring the lines, sending the kids over to grandma's house 3 days a week or something.
And that's
like
a great
that.
Question. And no, they didn't initially. Child care was defined as care by anyone other than a child's mother. And I even point out at Seven Myths that you really, there are two ways of looking at this. There's no denying the fact that care in an institution-like setting with lots of other people versus home care maybe with one mom and three kids or grandma care one-on-one or any type of one-on-one care for that matter, nannies, is obviously, there's obviously a big difference there. And certainly the one-on-one care or the few on-one care is markedly better than the other. And again, people know that. If you were to ask everybody, would you like a nanny if money were no object and they wanted to go back to work, if you offered them nanny or daycare, they're all going to pick nanny. So people, once again, know that that one-on-one is so significant, and that's what makes daycare such a lose-lose situation, because as long as there's so many people using it, there's never going to be that low teacher or caregiver-child ratio. So that's what's causing daycare to be the mess that it is that there's this all this high turnover and children are experiencing these terrible losses over and over. Once they attach themselves to somebody, the person leaves. And we can't fix that. We've been trying for 30 years to fix that. And even Stanley Greenspan, who was a child psychologist and has spoken out about daycare for years, has pointed out that the only way we can actually improve daycare is to have fewer people using it.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to pick up on that. It sounds like a pipe dream. Fewer people using daycare. If you'd like to react to this new study on the impact of daycare on children, call during this break. It's a good time to call 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, we're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 27th of March, issues ETC at KFUO.org. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. Suzanne Venker is our guest. She's a former middle school teacher, married mother of two here in St. Louis, and author of the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. When we come back, we'll spend about another 10 minutes with her and get your reaction to the new study on the impact of daycare on children. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you thinking about a gift for your kids or your grandkids for the Easter season? Well, think about our Issues Etc. book of the month for March, called Easter Is For Me. It's a children's book set in rhyme and verse. It tells the story of Jesus' death and resurrection for sinners. It's the Easter story. You can find Easter Is For Me at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The other is at 3558 South Jefferson in the city. When you visit, ask for Easter Is For Me, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. Those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March called Easter Is For Me. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org.
A UCLA psychiatrist says in a new book that abortion hurts women.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Dr. Miriam Grossman of UCLA has written a new book entitled Unprotected, A Campus Psychiatrist Reveals How Political Correctness in Her Profession Endangers Every Student. Grossman wrote the book in part to highlight the existence of an invisible group, women and men with emotional scars from an abortion. They are out there in numbers, she says, but many must seek support from outside the mental health system. According to Grossman, individual practitioners may be sensitive to the trauma of abortion, but the mental health establishment denies it exists.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. It was my daily routine for one whole year. After lunch, I would go into the office and find a little piece of paper with five or six names on it. Those were the people I was supposed to visit that afternoon. Some were in homes, others in hospitals, still others in nursing homes. 6 days of the week, except Saturday when I was only given four names. It was the school year of 1971-1972, and I was doing my ministerial internship at Calvary Lutheran Church in Lincoln Park, Michigan, downriver, for you who know the Detroit area. My supervising pastor that year was Reverend Otto Krupski, and he was a marvelous influence upon all the subsequent years I've had in the ministry. The idea that a minister should go and see people seemed natural enough to me. My father was a milkman who taught me that you don't get new customers by waiting for them to come to you. You seek them out. And didn't Jesus tell parables about seeking the lost coin and the lost sheep? Luke chapter 15. I often wonder how much better things might be in the church if we would put more daily effort into seeking people out. Well, my mentor and friend, Otto Krupski, is buried today. My sincerest condolences to his family, and my thanks to God for all Pastor taught me. I'm Dale Meyer.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talking with Suzanne Venker, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. You probably heard about this new study on the impact of daycare on children. It was really an Eber study of kids. We're talking about 5 years, over 1,000 children tracked as the same subjects. It was very strictly controlled. And it concluded that there are behavioral problems after long terms of daycare. And maybe your kids' verbal skills might improve. Of course, you could probably improve their verbal skills at home just as well. Maybe being in a family like mine when I was raised with many siblings kind of has a tendency to improve your verbal skills, although we did our fair share of acting out in the house as well. But we want to hear from you, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or via email issuesetc@kfuo.org. Suzanne, we were talking before, and you mentioned that, I can't remember the name, someone said the only way to improve the quality of daycare is to reduce the number of people using it?
Dr. Stanley Greenspan, who along with Barry Brazelton has been, you know, they're eminent child psychologists who have written about daycare, children's needs, and they have gone back and forth over the last 30 years about being PC, you know, and saying what they're supposed to say as the times go on. And he finally... I don't know when, less than 10 years ago, pointed out that daycare has, we have tried to improve daycare through all these various means, i.e. money being a big one, because of course that's always the big thing in the media. You just pour more money into something and boom, you have a great system going. And to no avail. We have tried and tried and tried to no avail, and the only way you could actually improve it is to have those who are actually capable of staying home with their children financially to choose to do so, then then daycare could have a fighting chance, meaning that if it stayed small the way it initially was, which was really just for people who were truly in need and had exhausted every other means to care for their children, or they fell on hard times, or they got divorced, or what have you, if you kept it just for that group rather than opening it up to just any woman who would rather not be at home because it's too hard or what have you, then you could keep it small and deal with it in a better way.
Is there, to your knowledge, any comparative study between, or was this study itself comparative between children with extended periods of time spent in daycare and children not spending time in daycare?
Other than these 1,364 children, you mean?
Right.
No. No. That's the best of my knowledge. And it's a great question because the bottom line is when you go back and forth on this subject, what you're always going to get is someone who says, well, when I, you know, was young, I did this and I turned out great. And you hear all this stuff, and there's always a story, and everybody will come back at you with something else. So it's very hard to, you know, prove the existence of what happens with one person who's been at home and one who's not. But the problem with that is that for example, you hear people when they talk about daycare, they no longer use the term daycare. I don't know if you've noticed that. They use the term child care. That changed about 5 to 7 years ago. And the reason for that is that so many young people under the age of 5 are in some type of child care situation prior to entering kindergarten. And they also didn't distinguish between, when they did this study, those who are in who started preschool, say, at the age of 3.5 for a few hours a week, from those who did full-time daycare from 6 weeks on. And, of course, that's a very important distinction because you hear that in the media a great deal today where they just talk about child care as though that's all the same thing. So, for example, I've been home since day one, and when my children were 3.5, they started preschool 2 or 3 mornings a week for a few hours, which is actually about a year later than most people today. I don't know if you know that, but they started about 2.5 now.
That's unbelievable.
And I'm literally the only person I know, whose children started at the late age of 3.5. And even when I did, it was only 9 to 11:30, and they'll stretch it from 9 to 2, and then that gets into, but they call themselves a preschool, but then is that really daycare? So it's such a mess because we combine all this, you know, other mother care under the term child care. But there's a very big difference between daycare and going to nursery school. I went to nursery school when I was 3.5 all those years ago for a couple hours. That's not the same thing. And the couple hours is really the significant phrase here because, once again, going back to this study, that's the whole purpose of the study. It's not just the exposure to a child care environment. It's the long hours. So there's a big difference, for example, in a child who goes from 9 to 11:30 and comes home for the rest of the day, and the one who stays till 3 or 4 or 5. A huge difference. In fact, if you ask the daycare workers or even preschool teachers, they'll tell you there's a marked difference in the children after 12 o'clock or after lunchtime in terms of their behavior, in terms of their stamina, in terms of what their needs are, that a few hours is fine, but beyond that, bad news. And that's the whole purpose of this study. But once again, you don't hear that in the media.
See, there are only 24 hours in a day. And if a kid is sleeping for, you know, 9 or 10.
Right.
And then in daycare, and I'm thinking about maybe the average 4-year-old or something, mm-hmm. in daycare from 8 in the morning, if not earlier, mm-hmm. until maybe 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that leaves a very small amount of time for that kid to actually even be exposed to mom and dad.
And notice that in your the ABC clip there, and it wasn't just ABC. CBS and NBC did the same thing. They wanted to point out and emphasize that what mattered the most, though, in the end, was the parents' influence or the quality of parenting, I think is the phrase they used. But, of course, it's irrelevant. You can't say it in that way because there is no quality of parenting if you're only seeing them an hour a day, not to mention what goes on during that hour or two a day anyway. But in other words, there is no quality. But even if there were, it's still not enough. 2 hours a day is not enough. So, again, spinning it. missing the point. In fact, once again, this study, when the media comes back and their answer to this is to say, well, that's why it's so important that you find your quality of child care. They emphasize the quality of child care. Well, as a matter of fact, that isn't relevant because that's the whole purpose, once again, of this study. It controlled for that. They found out that what was significant was not the quality of care, but the amount of time. There was a connection between the amount of time and the reports of aggression and disobedience, regardless of the quality of the care. That's the point. In other words, children can't be away from mom too long, regardless of who it is. That's the point.
So even if you've got the super nanny on the other end of the line there.
Or even grandma.
It does not substitute for mom and dad.
Right.
When it comes to long-term daycare, do you think what we have here is a system that is being systematically abused by people?
Yes.
Or do we need to find an alternative to this thing?
Well, we certainly need to find an alternative. I don't know if we're going to. But, yes, I absolutely think it's being abused. And that's what's made it the mess that it is today, which is not to say, by the way, that daycare is okay for – I guess what I'm saying about keeping it small is that you can make a point that if the initial daycare plan, which was really for single mothers or lower-income families who had no choice because they had to go to work, you could make an argument that in those unfortunate situations, if you will, that those children could be better off in a healthier environment, particularly if mom's not going to be around anyway because she's got to go, put food on the table. But that is not the same thing as opening up to middle-class America who have the education, the ability, the wherewithal, the what have you, to raise their own children. If you open it up to them to just opt out of it, that's when daycare became, controlled and somewhat manageable to just a gigantic mess.
Does full-time daycare, and I say full-time meaning, the parents work full-time, so the kids are in daycare full-time.
Right.
Does full-time daycare make fiscal sense for the family? As far as you can tell?
Only if you're making only six figures. That's the only way. Or really up there, maybe 80, 90, maybe. But really, I say six figures, because once you factor in all of the costs that are incurred from going to work, and people don't think of it that way. They think you're just gaining by the second income, but that's not true. You have the taxes that are taken out of that income, plus you're taxed differently in being a dual-income family than a one. And all the transportation, food, clothing-related costs. And then, of course, you have to pay someone. You have to pay for the child care itself. Once you factor all that in, the average family is netting about $6,000 or $7,000 a year. That's the average American family. Now, once you're up into the six figures, as I say, certainly you're coming out ahead financially. You're losing personally, in my opinion, but financially you would come out ahead, yes. But, of course, most people don't make six figures, so it's not really relevant.
Two quick final questions. This is a study, a five-year study. Can we hope for a longer-term study that may even attempt to measure the effects of full-time daycare, extended periods of daycare for kids, past the ages when they would be in daycare in most cases, into their elementary school age years?
Well, that's what this one did. They're up to fifth grade, I think, now.
Oh, fifth grade.
Yeah, yeah. That was the whole point. See, in April of 2001, they weren't there yet. The kids were still about three or four. Now this is what? 5 years, 6 years later. Now, I think it's sixth grade they're in now. Actually, I take that back. Sixth grade. And yes, they are going to continue. If that's what you asked me before,
yes.
I'm sorry.
No, that's perfect.
Yes, no, they are going to continue. They're going to stay with it, I think, up through till graduation. Actually, no, I take that back. Into their 20s. This study is the most comprehensive that I think there ever will be.
One more thing. We heard about this a couple weeks ago. It's a new study that found that somehow working mothers are spending the same amount of time with their kids as the stay-at-home moms did in the 1970s. And according to the report, they're giving up sleep, housework, and time with their husband, among other things. Your reaction to
right.
that study?
Well, the reason they could say that with a straight face was because they omitted all of those things that differentiate the 1950s mom from today. Number one, they had more children. we have fewer children, and the idea is that, so if you take the average mom who has, say, 6 or 7 kids and the one who has 2, the idea is, well, I have so much more time on my hands because I only have 2 kids, so I give them all my attention. And then when I am home for those 2 hours a day, I give them my undivided attention, meaning I'm not cooking, I'm not cleaning, I'm not errand running, I'm literally on the floor doing that floor time, which, A, I don't believe that anyway, but even if that were true, it's completely irrelevant because the growth, children being raised in their homes by their own parents is not about floor time. It's not about 10 hours of floor time at all. It's about living life with your mom at your side in whatever manner that may be. And that might be your outside playing, but she's physically available to address all needs as they come up, not necessarily hanging out on the floor with you. Of course, you do some of that as well. But that's what they dismissed. They were saying, my floor time, my 2 hour floor time is equal to your floor time in a 10 hour day because you probably only spend 2 hours a day when floor time, which is true, except the other 8 are just as significant as the 2 on the floor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So mom taking the kid to the grocery store.
Yeah, all that learning stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Folks, you can find out more about Suzanne Venker's book called 7 Myths of Working Mothers at www.spencepublishing.com. You can also order it by calling Spence Publishing. Their toll-free number is 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB. Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher. She's a married mother of 2 kids here in St. Louis and author of this book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd never heard of them before. Sounds to me like something you buy when you're going into the movies, a piece of candy, Jew boos. But when you hear what a Jew boo is, it doesn't exactly surprise you. Judaism today is a religion that some people have said you can even be an atheist and be a Jew. Is that true? You can certainly be an atheist and be a Buddhist, because that's what a Jew boo is, a Jew who practices Buddhism. Could it be that these two religions actually have more in common with one another than they don't? Especially if you're willing to concede that Judaism doesn't necessarily have to even be a theistic religion. We're going to talk about Jews who practice Buddhism with Doug LeBlanc. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or 1-800-730-2727. We'll spend just a few minutes with him, and then at the 4 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about Christian teaching with Pastor Ronnie Cook of Good News Magazine. Doug LeBlanc is a freelance writer and reporter. He's a contributor to the blog GetReligion.org, and he's author of an article in the latest Christian research journal titled Jews Seek a Deeper Spiritual Life Through Buddhism. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Happy to talk with you.
How popular is the Jew boo phenomenon?
Well, I was struck that Roger Kamenetz, who wrote about it, and I think in many ways made popular the shorthand of Jew boos, he wrote in his book, The Jew in the Lotus, that Jewish participation in American Buddhism ranges anywhere from 6% to 30%, which compares to 2.5% for the American population. So it seems, I would say, unusually high, if his figures still hold true.
Most people wouldn't put these two things together. They would consider Judaism and Buddhism, even in the West, where everything kind of melts together, as far apart on the pole as you could probably put two different religions. So how is it that they've found each other?
I think it's a spiritual hunger among Jews. I think one of the more insightful thoughts on that came from the rabbi who is thought of in many ways as their patriarch. His name is Zalman Schachter Shalomi, and he was saying that in the time after World War II, a lot of Jews were feeling spiritually empty, and that they felt that Judaism had largely become like another denomination of liberal Protestantism, and that synagogues, you know, would look rather like liberal Protestant churches, with obviously the exception of a cross. You know, you wouldn't have a cross or much less a crucifix, you know, in a synagogue, but kind of a sterile, you know, community room environment almost is the sense I got.
What role did the Holocaust play as far as you can surmise?
Well, two things there. He pointed out, the same rabbi pointed out that the Holocaust nearly destroyed the oral traditions of Judaism, especially its oral traditions of mysticism, and that left it hollow. Far more controversially, he believes that the Holocaust created recycled souls who came back to the earth as baby boomers, who were seeking, who were spiritually hungry as well. And, you know, that's just pretty much impossible for me to wrap my head around, you know, that working from a base of any branch of Judaism, one could get to the point of believing in reincarnation. But
so the Holocaust victims, according to his theory, and I take it from your article, it's not his alone, at least some of them came back as the baby boomers?
That's what he suggested, yeah. And, I mean, without irony at all. In fact, he referred me to a book that argues that case at greater length, and it's called Beyond the Ashes, Cases of Reincarnation from the Holocaust. So, I, you know, I, how that works exactly, I guess it's possible. You know, if you're willing to believe in reincarnation, obviously, I mean, if you take that big step, then I guess at least he's not arguing that, you know, that these recycled souls were conceived during World War II. You know, it's not, at least that's not how I read him. But yeah, I guess it's not even comparable to Mormonism in that respect, because, you know, Mormons would say that you believe you exist before you're born, and you're waiting to be embodied, basically. But he's suggesting a recycling effect, and so. But I'm not sure that it would be fair, you know, to say that all Jubus, you know, believe that that they're recycled. You know, that baby boomer Jubus would believe that they're recycled souls from the Holocaust or whatever. I think that would be the experimental theology of this particular rabbi, and I'm sure there are people in the movement who agree with him, and there are others who who don't.
What kind of an obstacle is theism for the Jews who are seriously considering incorporating the beliefs and practices of Buddhism into their lives?
Well, I think certainly if those Jews just looked at the Ten Commandments, I guess, you know, that would be a beginning. I mean, in the sense of having no other gods before the God of Israel. I guess one of the more striking things for me in writing this article was a particular detail that comes up again in Roger Kamenetz's book, and it's a discussion between a Jubu and a straight up Buddhist, a Tibetan Buddhist nun, and the Jubu woman was saying that her sense of where she and her friend divided the most strongly had to do with the Tibetan Buddhist nun found it impossible to accept the fact that when you die, you're dead, that's it. And so you have this strange thing where the Buddhist, you know, coming from a tradition that is not known for being theistic even, is affirming a belief in the afterlife, and the Jewish American is categorically denying the afterlife. It really turns one's expectations on their head, you know, pretty thoroughly.
We were talking about some other subject on the program recently, And we played some audio from a female rabbi who said, look, you really don't even have to be a theist to be a Jew in America today. I don't know exactly what she meant, but it seemed to me that if there are some who believe that one need not even believe in a God, any God, then Buddhism is not a big jump for those kind of Jews.
Yeah, yeah, I would say that's precisely the case. And I would really like to get to know those kinds of Jewish folks better to quite understand what it is they see Judaism as being about. Because at that point, it seems like it may be just a kind of a cultural inheritance, you know, what kind of foods you may eat, not necessarily in the sense of abstaining from foods, but what kind of foods you give a special attention to, a matter of having a sense of humor maybe, or knowing Yiddish, I would find it maddening, you know, to be part of a tradition that has been so desiccated in a sense that there's no sense of a unified theology that you stand on and say, this is what we're about.
How would you characterize the critics of the Jubu movement, if we can call it that?
Well, I think it has attracted some criticism from within Orthodox circles within Judaism. I had trouble getting any of the critics to talk to me. I wrote to one rabbi who's 37 years old, which I found, you know, really, I guess, encouraging, really, that you have someone from what's normally called Generation X, and he's a blogger, and he's a campus rabbi for Hillel chapters in the greater Los Angeles area. And I just ended up quoting briefly from an article that he wrote. And I'll just quote part of that here. From his perspective, what attracts Jews to Buddhism are kernels of wisdom that God planted there. Why did God do this? Hashem planted those kernels in order to test us. The popularity of Buddhism, the Dalai Lama, and Buddhist tchotchkes, trinkets, challenge each and every Jew to learn about their own heritage. Torah, Kabbalah, and ancient Jewish prayer and meditation, as examples, represent the most unbelievably deep wisdom. Torah teaches how to engage life, the godly spark in each person, the nobility of each breath, and the humility to know our place in creation. So, you know, in a sense, I would say this kind of critic of Jubu's would, if you will, he's sort of the Jewish equivalent of Christian Research Journal, I suppose.
Doug LeBlanc is a freelance writer.